This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Kroger CEO Rodney McMullen resigned this week. Today on our weekly news review, we'll discuss what we know and what we don't about a personal conduct probe that led to his resignation and who's stepping in as the company's interim CEO. We'll also talk about a Kentucky House vote on legislation to ban DEI in higher education and why some students and the League of Women Voters are criticizing the process. And we'll hear why Sam Hubbard decided to retire from the NFL and how the Bengals front office is reshaping the team's roster. Joining me now to kick off the news review, our WCPO9 I-Team reporter, Dan Monk. Welcome back, Dan.
Hey, Lucy.
And Cincinnati Business Courier managing editor, Andy Brownfield. Thanks for being here, Andy.
Thanks for having me.
Andy, Kroger announced Monday morning, bright and early, that Rodney McMullen had resigned from his job as CEO. How did the company explain his resignation?
So the company said in a press release that on February 21st, the board was alerted that there was an alleged violation of the company's ethics code. And they had an independent outside counsel launch an investigation into that. And then that culminated in, on March 2nd, Rodney McMullen resigning and interim CEO Ron Sargent, who was the lead independent director and former Staples CEO, taking his place as the board conducts a search for his full-time replacement.
Ah, okay. Dan, have we learned any more about the personal conduct that it was at the center of that investigation?
We've learned absolutely nothing about that conduct. No. They said that the board began the investigation on February 21st, and he was gone, of course, by early this week. So that seems to indicate that there was at least some behavior that would come to the attention of a board and result in an immediate resignation. However, they haven't revealed really any details about what it involved, except that it did not involve business operations and it did not involve any other Kroger employees.
Okay. Andy, what was Rodney McMullen's history with Kroger? He'd been with the company for quite a while, hadn't he?
He had been. His career spanned almost five decades with Kroger, and that started with, you know, what a lot of college students and high school students will do, myself included, bagging groceries, stocking shelves. But then after he graduated college, he joined the company's corporate team in finance. And I believe he was in Charlotte, North Carolina first before coming back to the headquarters downtown. And he kind of rose the ranks, ultimately becoming chief financial officer, then president and CEO before being named CEO in 2014. But even prior to that, he was involved with a lot of really big actions. I mean, he was credited by the company with being instrumental in a restructuring in 1988 that kept the company public and warded off a hostile takeover. And also, you know, prior to his becoming CEO, being instrumental in the acquisition of Fred Meyer, which added a ton of stores. I believe it was a $13 billion merger that happened there.
Hmm. Dan, how did other Cincinnati business leaders react to this news? This seemed like it surprised a lot of people.
Yeah, people were very surprised. I talked to John Barrett, who said that, he didn't see this coming in any way. He said McMullen is a first-rate citizen of this city in every way. Gave him a lot of credit for his leadership on the Cincinnati Business Committee and the Cincinnati Center City Development Corporation, and for making Kroger a cornerstone partner in the effort to keep the Cincinnati Open Tennis Tournament from leaving town last year. I also interviewed Eric Kearney, the head of the African American Chamber of Commerce, and he told me a story about one of his members who was trying to get a barbecue sauce into Kroger, and he called Rodney and asked him for help, and that led to a phone conversation where Rodney spent some time patiently explaining, the purchasing process to this guy, and Kearney said he was kind of blown away by that action. He figured McMullen would just pass off the assignment to somebody else, but instead he took the time to explain what it takes to get onto a Kroger shelves. And he said this an entrepreneur really benefited from that.
Mm. Well, those are people who are obviously fans of Rodney McMullen. What kind of reaction did you hear from union leaders, Dan?
Well, they weren't as positive. they said that, it's time for Kroger to stop failing in mergers or stop investing in mergers and failed technology and instead focus on benefiting consumers by lowering prices and helping workers with higher wages. You know, one of the things about McMullen's career is that he did figure out a lot of ways to lower prices, to boost employee wages. One of the reasons Kroger is successful is that it had this policy of looking for cost savings that it could reinvest in the business. And that is one reason why they've been successful, for more than a decade now. They're competing against much larger competitors, Walmart and Amazon. And they're doing a good job of holding their market share in cities where they compete and sometimes growing market share against these big companies.
Well, Dan, with all that said, what was the investor reaction to this news?
Well, I mean, Kroger's stock price today is about where it was before Rodney resigned. So I would say investors are taking the news well. I did talk to one analyst who said he's not changing any of his outlooks on the company. He still expects their profit range to be where he expected it to be before that. And the company came out with earnings yesterday and basically reaffirmed that. I think their profit guidance is slightly lower than it was before the yesterday's outlook announcement, but they're still expecting 2 to 3% growth in identical store sales, which is the key measure that everybody looks at with Kroger.
Andy, you mentioned Kroger's interim CEO. Tell us what more do we know about him and his history with the company?
So he actually also started his career at Kroger, same as Rodney, with stocking shelves and the like. But then when he was working through Harvard and then Harvard Business School, following that, he joined Kroger's corporate team. Before leaving and embarking on his career outside of Kroger, most recently as the CEO of Staples, where he was responsible for its push into e-commerce, growing it into, I believe, the sixth largest e-commerce retailer in the 90s in its heyday. And he served as CEO of Staples until about 2016 when it embarked on a failed bid for Office Depot. Since then, though, he's been serving on Kroger's board and most recently as the lead independent director. And, as CEO during the call with investors yesterday following their earnings, he said that he was not going to be a status quo CEO. But at the same time, he said that Kroger's got a solid plan for 2025 and he looks forward to seeing that through.
And Andy, you mentioned that the company is going to be looking for a permanent CEO. What has Kroger said about how that search will happen or what their next moves are with that?
So it's a strange time for Kroger because it's seen a lot of turnover as of late in its C-suite. So, Ron Sargent said that the company every year updates its specifications as part of its CEO succession plan for what it looks for in a top leader. But, it has a new CFO who is actually just getting started after the end of this fiscal year, replacing the interim CFO. And they are launching a nationwide search, they said, with a search firm. They didn't name who that was, but they said they'd also be looking internally and externally for candidates for the top role.
Yeah. Dan, anything else you want to add about what you think Kroger will be looking for in its next CEO?
Somebody that can help them fend off the big challengers. I mean, the problem they had going into their decision to try to merge with Albertsons remains today. They're going to have it a harder and harder time competing against Amazon and Walmart because they're investing billions of dollars into same day delivery, and they're far ahead of Kroger when it comes to that kind of shopping, which is growing. And so unless they can figure out how to compete on a sort of a level basis with these much bigger competitors, the risk is that they're going to lose market share as time goes on and have a harder time competing.
Well, Dan, I want to talk to you about another story you reported this week. You had an update on how much Hamilton County is paying the stadium negotiations expert that the county hired. Tell us about that. What's going on there?
Well, his name is David Abrams. He's with a New York company called Inner Circle Sports, and he's fairly well known in the industry for advising municipalities on how to negotiate with teams. He's brokered major sports construction deals in Atlanta, Houston, Miami, Tampa, Jacksonville, and Nashville. And the county actually hired him or put him on retainer in 2023. However, they only recently set the pricing details for his contract. And basically what he's paid is a retainer of $25,000 a month. He's made $100,000 so far. He's charged the county only for four of the months that he's, been on retainer. And he can get additional fees that total about $1 million, including $450,000, if his advice leads to a new lease with the Cincinnati Bengals.
And what kind of track record does David Abrams have? I mean, you mentioned he'd been involved in a lot of deals. Has he been, whose side has he been working for normally?
I think he mostly consults for municipalities, and his specialty is figuring out the various funding options that are available to both teams and to municipalities so that he can help them structure a deal that is favorable to both sides, essentially. He's according to his contract, he's going to work on things like analyzing direct funding options or off balance sheet options for the county. And then also analyzing venue specific financing for things like personal seat licenses, naming rights, and other kinds of stadium sponsored funding.
And remind us about the timeline for these negotiations. When does the county's lease expire with the Bengals?
The lease expires in June 30th of 2026. And there's a key deadline coming up on June 30th of this year. That's the date by which the team has to decide whether to just extend the lease under its current terms for 2 years. So that's why all of these talks are sort of, becoming more and more urgent right now, because there's just a few months left for the county to get a deal, or they'll have to stick with the current lease that they have until, for two more years. So a lot of people think that they're trying to push to get a deal before then. However, the Bengals kind of have all the cards. They have the unilateral right to extend the lease for two more years, but they have to make that known by June 30th of this year.
Hmm. Yeah, I was going to ask what kind of leverage the county has, even with this expert on board.
Well, I don't know that any municipality has leverage against any NFL team, but in recent years, NFL teams have been paying higher percentages of the total cost of deals. So, even in this case, the Bengals have offered in the past to pay up to $120 million, half of it coming from them and half of it coming from the NFL. So, it's not going to be the same kind of structure as they had in 2000, where the team basically only had to pay for less than 10% of the total cost of the stadium, and they get most of the revenue from it.
Okay. Well, we'll continue to watch that. I've been talking with WCPO9 I-Team reporter Dan Monk and Cincinnati Business Courier managing editor Andy Brownfield. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Up next, a Kentucky House committee draws criticism for how it passed legislation to ban DEI in higher education, and UC students continue to protest how the university is handling DEI there. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Kentucky lawmakers this week voted on a bill related to diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives at public colleges in the state. The way the bill passed through committee drew criticism from some students and other legislative observers. That same day the committee voted in Frankfurt, students at the University of Cincinnati held another protest over the way the university is handling state and federal DEI mandates there. Joining me now to talk about all of this are Kentucky Public Radio Capitol reporter Sylvia Goodman. Welcome back, Sylvia.
Glad to be here.
And WVXU education reporter Zach Carrion. Thanks for being here, Zach.
Always good to be here, Lucy.
Sylvia, you refer to this as one of the most controversial bills of Kentucky's current legislative session. I know it passed out of the House on Wednesday, but before that, there was a heated committee meeting. What are lawmakers looking to do when it comes to diversity, equity, and inclusion in higher education?
Sure. So, yes, it went through committee on Tuesday, and then it passed out of the House on party lines in both cases. And essentially, what the bill is trying to do is eliminate, in total, all DEI programs at public colleges and universities. No resources, including donated resources, can be used on quote-unquote DEI initiatives. I mean, the definition of how they define diversity, equity, and inclusion is both broad and specific. Let me see if I can find it here. I have the 43-page bill open. It does a lot of things in here, but the way they define DEI initiatives is a policy, practice, or procedure to promote or provide differential treatment or benefits to individuals on the basis of religion, race, sex, color, national origin, et cetera, et cetera. So it's really broadly defined and also specific. I think some people in diversity, equity, inclusion would take issue with that definition. But in general, what it seeks to eliminate all of those programs, those offices, staff members who specifically do diversity, equity, and inclusion work at public universities and colleges.
Well, and you know, we've talked about how there was this committee meeting, I think, on Tuesday, and it got a little bit tense. How much time was allotted for this committee hearing on this 43-page bill?
I would say very tense. It was one of the most tense committee hearings I've been to so far this year, at least. I mean, this bill also, in a very similar form, not exactly the same, but pretty similar, came up last year as well. And so it was pretty some tense hearings last year, too. But what they did is they had an 8 a.m. committee hearing, which is the normal time for this post-secondary education committee to meet at a regularly scheduled 8 a.m. meeting. And they allotted a 1 hour for it, which is, I would say, the normal length for a committee hearing. However, oftentimes committee heads will either choose to put off a vote if the conversation is going too long and put it off to another meeting, or they'll call a special meeting for bills they know are extra controversial. But this was the only bill on the schedule for that Tuesday morning meeting. And they essentially, the committee head told everyone in the room that no matter what happened, at 8:55, they were taking a vote on that bill. And a conversation from the supporters of the legislation, so the sponsor and the people that she had at the table with her, and questions from lawmakers to the sponsor took a total of 40 minutes out of that meeting. And after she left the table, the committee chair gave 10 minutes for everyone who was opposed to the bill. There were a lot of people who signed up to speak on that bill who were not given the opportunity to do so because of that strict time limit.
And did the committee chairman explain why supporters got so much more time than opponents of this legislation?
Well, he essentially, I suppose, attributed it to the questions from lawmakers. I should note that I think it was about 15 to 20 minutes of just the supporters talking and explaining the bill and explaining their viewpoint on why it's important. And then they had 20 minutes of lawmakers asking questions. The committee chair did not limit the answers to those questions, so often those went pretty lengthy, too. I think there's only a total of 3 questions asked from Democratic lawmakers, and they answered gave some pretty lengthy responses to those answers. So there was definitely criticism from Democratic lawmakers on that committee about the time allotment. And essentially what the sponsor said is that, well, you know, you asked the questions, I'm going to let them answer them. And that I was told by leadership that they wanted this bill voted on today, and that's what we did.
Hmm. Well, here's State Representative Jennifer Decker talking about the legislation.
This question about whether the DEI that is banned by this bill, which is preferences and prejudicial treatment, that is no longer debatable about whether it's a good thing to do, a bad thing to do, will it help, will it not. It is unconstitutional, says the Supreme Court of the United States of America.
Tell us a little bit more about what supporters of this legislation are arguing. Why do they say it's needed?
Sure. So that is one of the main arguments, is that they argue that the recent Supreme Court decision, and I believe it's the Students for Fair Admission versus Harvard case, that said that all DEI programs are unconstitutional. Now, I would say advocates of DEI disagree with that reading of the Supreme Court decision. That decision was fairly limited to admissions, college admissions, so that you aren't allowed to give preferential treatment on the basis of race in college admissions. A lot of people argue that various DEI programs, for example, recruitment initiatives, or which this bill would ban, or scholarships specific to certain students and backgrounds, or maybe you have a DEI office that puts on special programs designed for students of specific backgrounds or sexes or religions or what have you, that those were not banned by that Supreme Court decision. The sponsor of this bill, as you just heard, Jennifer Decker, disagrees with that reading of the Supreme Court decision. She also points to our Attorney General, Russell Coleman, has also kind of issued some decisions that seem to agree with her, or opinions, not decisions. Attorney Generals don't issue decisions, but he's written some opinions that would seem to agree with her on that matter, that the Supreme Court decision essentially, they believe, was broader than how opponents of this bill are reading it.
Well, after the vote, some students questioned Representative James Tipton, who is the committee chair outside the committee room.
You're not letting us get our voices in.
And what did the League of Women Voters have to say? They also voiced some concerns about this process, didn't they?
Yeah, they have. And they've been fairly critical of how the legislature has either, they believe, fast-tracked legislation to limit or with the effect of limiting input. Or, you know, for example, they were very critical of this specific committee hearing because on top of the limited opposition, debate that was allowed, they also released a committee substitute on the bill that was not available until testimony had already begun. This is a pretty common practice in Frankfurt where they will, you'll have a bill and, you know, myself, a reporter, and also advocates and lobbyists and citizens who are trying to engage in the process will read the legislation as it was filed. But then once you show up to the committee hearing, the bill sponsor will say, well, I have a committee substitute I'd like to put in. And then they may explain the changes that that committee substitute makes. They might not. And then they vote on the committee substitute, not on the original bill that you may have shown up to testify about. And so sometimes the changes are minimal and sometimes the changes are pretty expansive. And you don't really know until afterwards. It can be hours after the vote until LRC, the Legislative Research Commission, puts that new substitute up on the website. And so that's a big criticism of theirs, of this process. And then also the president of the League of Women Voters actually came to testify against this bill herself, and she was not able to speak because of the strict time limitations.
Hmm. What's next with this legislation, Sylvia? I mentioned it passed the House on Wednesday, I believe. How quickly could it move through the Senate?
Well, that's really a question of how much they stick to the strict reading of the rules here. So essentially, what's required in Kentucky law is that a bill get three readings on the floor of each chamber before it's passed out of it. And that usually, by a very strict interpretation of the rules, would mean after a committee has already viewed it and any committee substitute, committee changes are reviewed and put onto the bill and it's passed out. But what the leadership of the chambers have frequently done is they give it readings before it even comes up in that committee. So we don't even know what that final committee substitute version is. And that's what's happened on House Bill 4. It's gone to the Senate now. Now that it's passed the House, and it's gotten readings on the floor of the Senate. And before it's gotten a Senate hearing, it could show up. I'm not sure if it will, but there is a Senate education hearing on Monday, so it could show up in that committee. And after that, it could be voted on very quickly.
Well, Zach, we've been talking about this DEI legislation in Kentucky. Protests continue this week on the University of Cincinnati's campus over pressure to eliminate DEI initiatives there. Explain the pressure that the university is facing.
Well, they're feeling pressure kind of from all sides. They're feeling pressure from the federal government, the U.S. Department of Education, who sent out some directives last month and have since updated those directives. But they're also feeling pressure from state legislators. There's a Senate Bill 1, which is currently in the House right now. And basically what it is they're looking at these DEI programs and wanting them to cut it out. So there were protests earlier at the Board of Trustees meetings, really big crowd, hundreds of students there, putting pressure on university leaders to hold on to these DEI initiatives. And at the University of Cincinnati right now, that appears to be what's happening. They haven't yet eliminated their DEI departments or programs or scholarships, related minority scholarships, things like that. Those are still around right now. A lot of people on campus think that is due to pressure from students and faculty who are speaking out against this. And those protests have continued. There was one on Tuesday of this week. I actually believe there's one happening on campus now, today. So the students, faculty are keeping up the pressure, not letting this issue kind of fall into obscurity about DEI and these other programs.
How has the university's president, Neville Pinto, responded to all this? What has he said?
Well, when he was confronted by students, he said that for now, these DEI programs are still going to be around. But really, since then, we haven't heard anything from him. So people on campus are certainly waiting to hear what those next steps are going to be, if they're going to take any action. And I spoke with the faculty union president at UC, Steve Mockaby, and he says really the right move for universities right now would actually be not taking any action. Some people did criticize the university for complying in advance and kind of setting things up to eliminate certain DEI things and make certain changes on campus when they necessarily didn't have to. Because this directive coming from the U.S. Department of Education, it's a directive. It's not a law. It can be challenged in court and things can change. So they're really encouraging, he's really encouraging colleges and universities to kind of wait and see how things played out, because the Department of Education sent out this directive earlier last month. And, it was pretty clear on what it was identifying. Now, it didn't necessarily identify DEI specifically, but it said, anything that even could be somewhat related to DEI or minority students could qualify. Now, they actually have since kind of backtracked on that, saying
this is the U.S. Department of Education kind of backtracked.
Okay. Yeah, the U.S. Department of Education has since kind of backtracked on that, putting out different guidance that now says, certain things like student groups or certain observances of months or holidays like Black History Month, Holocaust Remembrance Day, well, those don't count as DEI as long as they're not excluding anybody. So we're seeing the U.S. Department of Education put out different messaging about DEI, and it's really causing a lot of confusion, because on one hand, you have some universities that aren't doing anything. But even after this new guidance, you have universities like Ohio University, which actually just canceled its Black alumni reunion, and Ohio State, which has already cut its DEI office and laid off dozens of workers. So we're seeing universities do all kinds of different things here, and they're really not on the same page, and it's causing a lot of confusion about what they should be doing.
Yeah. Sylvia, what have you seen or heard about universities in Kentucky?
Yeah. So, I mean, even before the Trump administration took over and this guidance was causing all this confusion, a bunch of Kentucky universities were already starting to try to eliminate or limit their DEI programs because of pressure from the state legislature. So this was already happening in Kentucky starting last year. For example, Northern Kentucky University, which obviously is very close to Cincinnati, it eliminated its office of, I believe it was called Inclusive Excellence, and their chief DEI officer also stepped down. And that was, it seemed, in response to, pressure from the state legislature. So we've already been seeing this happening in Kentucky, and there have also been statewide protests from students. That happened a few weeks ago, that I believe that there's a protest on most public university campuses, if not all, in Kentucky, calling for DEI. But we're already seeing this happening in Kentucky as well.
Mm. Zach, are you expecting these protests to continue? You said there might be one happening at UC's campus today.
Yeah, I do expect them to continue. I don't know if they'll be as large in size as some of the earlier ones, but especially here in Ohio with Senate Bill 1, like Sylvia just said, there was state pressure in Kentucky that forced schools like NKU to make some different moves. Now with Senate Bill 1, which would really enforce kind of these DEI related rules, very similar to what the U.S. Department of Education is talking about, we might actually see movement on that. So happened in Kentucky first, it could be happening in Ohio soon.
Mm. Well, Zach, I want to talk to you about some other concerns about the U.S. Department of Education. They spilled into Cincinnati Public Schools Board of Education meeting this week, too.
These cuts will affect real people, real children whose lives will be directly impacted by decisions made by President Trump and an unelected billionaire Elon Musk.
That was Michelle Dunn with the Cincinnati Federation of Teachers. Explain what she's talking about there.
What she's talking about are changes to the U.S. Department of Education. So Linda McMahon, who is now the head of that, has definitely been releasing a lot of statements and talking about what the future of the department is going to be. Now, it's kind of uncertain exactly what she's going to do, but she is a big proponent of school choice. She also wants to dismantle the department. That's part of the Trump administration's plan for the Department of Education. So it's really a lot of uncertainty. And that is also coupled by the Ohio state budget presented by DeWine, the proposed budget. And that would make some cuts to public education. It's $23.4 billion for education. But really, an analysis of that showed that that's going to be a lot of less money for schools. So Cincinnati Public Schools, Shauna Murphy, the superintendent, came out with a statement yesterday saying, if DeWine's proposed budget goes through, that's going to mean $27 million less in funding for the school district over 2 years. So that is a significant chunk. And when you look at school budgets, not just at CPS, really every other public school district, their biggest expense is paying teachers. It's salary and benefits for those teachers. So a number like $27 million, that's going to be hard to cut without, laying off a lot of staff.
Sure. What's the federal funding that seems to be at risk, at least in the minds of people like Michelle Dunn, who are worried about what the U.S. Education Department is thinking or doing? What kind of funding there are they talking about?
Well, there's really a lot of unknowns because, of course, they do get funding from the federal government. But, if the department is dismantled, what does that mean for the funding? There's not really a clear answer on that. And obviously a proponent of school vouchers, Linda McMahon, would that mean that some of that money would be going to a voucher program nationally? It's not really totally clear yet. So that's a lot of the anxiety there. And, they've seen what happened with school vouchers here in Ohio, which is almost $1 billion last year it cost the state. That funding is going up in this proposed budget bill by $500 million. So they're seeing the shift of money coming away from public schools and kind of going towards these school voucher programs. And they're worried about what that's going to mean for kids, especially kids low income and students with disabilities.
Goodness, a lot to follow with education. I've been talking with Kentucky Public Radio Capitol reporter Sylvia Goodman and WVXU education reporter Zach Carrion. Thank you both so much for your time today and for your reporting.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, we'll hear how the Cincinnati Bengals roster is changing for the upcoming season. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on WBXU. I'm Lucy May. The Cincinnati Bengals roster is reshaping, and the team will be playing the upcoming season without hometown favorite Sam Hubbard. Joining me now to walk us through these changes is Local 12 News digital sports reporter and host of the Skinny Podcast, Richard Skinner. Welcome back, Richard.
Hey, Lucy, how are you?
I'm doing all right. I hope you're well.
Doing well.
Good. Well, as I'm, you know, Sam Hubbard announced his retirement from the NFL after seven seasons with the Bengals. He's only 29. Why has he decided to retire?
Well, I think a couple of things. You know, they were going to probably cut him to save salary cap space. He was due about $9 million a year. I'm only surmising this. My guess is they went back and said, hey, we're going to cut you, but we'll offer you a year, $2.5-3 mil. Sam played really hurt this past year. I mean, I remember talking to him after like the third or fourth game, and he didn't really want to make a big deal of the injury situation. He had a bad hamstring injury, but he was playing through it. And I think for a guy that's probably done well banking his money, he's a finance major. He's got a bright future ahead of him and whatever he wants to do in life. I think at the point of, hey, you know, it's worth it for me to play at $9 million, but for two, it's probably not worth it to go through the injury stuff again. So Sam made the decision to go out on his own terms. I applaud him for that. You know, sometimes this business can be cruel, but there was no way, again, based on his performance last year, based on his injury history, they were going to pay him $9 million to play. And I'm just glad Sam, you know, did it on his terms. And I think he mentioned he wanted to retire as a Bengal, and that's what he's going to get a chance to do.
Yeah. 29 seems so young to me. Is that is it typical for an NFL player, though? They do get beat up.
Yeah, the line of demarcation a lot of times is 30. That's where a lot of teams don't want to pay guys into their 30s. Now, not everybody's built the same, right? Some guys are more injury prone than others leading up to 30. Some guys can continue to thrive in their 30s. And like Tom Brady continued to thrive into his mid-40s. That's such an outlier. It's ridiculous. But yeah, I mean, not every 30-year-old's built the same, but 30 is usually the line of demarcation. You don't usually want to pay guys into their 30s, and they're having to weigh that decision with Trey Hendrickson at the moment as well, who's 30 years old.
Mm. Tell us more about Sam Hubbard. He's a hometown guy with a lot of fans around here.
Yeah, no question. I mean, went to Moeller High School, won a couple state championships. It's funny. He was a safety at Moeller High School. He was really actually a really good lacrosse player. Went to Ohio State. They made him into a defensive end, kind of a little bit of an undersized defensive end, but a defensive end. He won a national championship there, and he was part of the resurgence here in Cincinnati. He was taking he's the last player on this roster with a tie to Marvin Lewis as a head coach. He was drafted in Marvin's last year and became a solid pro. I think that's the best I can do there. Nothing more than, people would look and go, he doesn't have a lot of sacks. And if you talk to a coach on that defensive staff, Sam Hubbard's the guy that when you have an assignment, he's going to do it. If his assignment is to set the edge and turn a runner in and let somebody else make the tackle, he did it. And when you have trust of coaches, you're going to get plenty of snaps. And so he made the most out of his career for sure. Again, to your point, 29 seems young, but in NFL standards, sometimes if you've had some injury history to you, it's not young. And again, these guys go, and not you, Lucy, but I think we all do this. Like you hear a guy's going to have knee surgery or shoulder surgery, and you don't think anything of it until you see him the next time around. And, you know, 6-8 months later, they're all good. Well, they just got cut on a major surgery. I mean, I think we all take that for granted in sports when guys have injuries and have surgeries, like, oh, it's just part and parcel of the business. But also the human body can only take so much.
Sure. Well, and you talked about him as a solid pro. He's had some really memorable plays, hasn't he?
Yeah, I mean, you talk about probably one of the most iconic plays, if not the most iconic play in Bengals history, that fumble return in the playoffs against Baltimore, where he scooped it out of the air, ran 98 yards as Baltimore was getting ready to take a lead. Instead, he gives the Bengals the lead in a playoff game that they won. And an iconic call for Mike Tirico, the Cincinnati kid, making a mark. And it certainly was just a great play. But he even talked about two more favorite plays that he had. Were in the AFC Championship game against Kansas City in 2021 when he sacked Patrick Mahomes twice. That kind of helped the Bengals win that game in overtime and go to the Super Bowl. And then this will be a great bar trivia question for everybody one day. What was Sam Hubbard's final play in a Bengals uniform? Was it a sack? Did he tackle somebody for a safety? Was it a tackle for loss? No, his final play was him catching a touchdown pass when he lined up as a fullback in Tennessee. That's when he suffered his final injury. And as goofy sounds, that's a crazy way to go out. That the last play that you had as a defensive end was an offensive touchdown.
Oh my gosh, that is wild. Well, let's talk about what's next for the Bengals without Sam Hubbard. Where does the team need to beef up its roster?
You know, a lot of places they need help on the interior defensive tackle. They've allowed Trey Hendrickson to seek a trade because the defensive end market got reset when Las Vegas Raiders and Max Crosby signed a contract worth roughly $35 million per year. I don't think the Bengals have any thoughts of going to that number with Trey Hendrickson. So they're letting him find out what's he worth on the open market. What could the Bengals get back? And it's understandable if they can't pay him for an extension. He's actually said either extend me or trade me. So they're going to let him go find out what he's worth and find out what another team's willing to pay him. And if they get something back in return, great. That's what they need to do. But at that point, you need two defensive ends, at least a defensive tackle. They're probably going to cut Jermaine Pratt, a linebacker. So you're going to need a starting linebacker. They let Alex Kappa go, and rightfully so, to save some cap space. And he was getting up there a little bit. But that leaves a void at guard. They need a tight end. It never hurts to get another safety in the safety room. So suffice it to say, it's a lot that they have to do. And though on top of it all, extend Ja'Marr Chase, was probably the highest contract paid to a non-quarterback in NFL history. And T. Higgins wants an extension, even though they franchise tagged him. I mean, it is a busy, busy offseason, and free agency starts on Monday.
Well, what's going on with the front office and T. Higgins?
I think you're at a spot where what's the number, what's the line in the sand? We don't know what the numbers are from either side. I saw a piece from Joel Corey, who's a former agent for CBSSports.com, in which he put T's value at about $31 million per year. I don't know if that's a comfortable category for the Bengals to go with T. They franchise tagged him, which means he either has to play for the Bengals this year or sit out. He gets $26 million guaranteed. He's probably not going to be happy doing that, but they do have until July 15th to work on a contract extension with him. And that's where it depends. Where's the line in the sand financially? Where are the Bengals comfortable in going, and where's T's camp comfortable in coming down from? It has to be taken into account, it can't be discounted that he's only played 12 games each of the last two seasons. He missed five games because of various injuries, and he's had some hamstring injury history. And I think you have to take that into account when you go with this. So, you know, they could also, with the franchise tag, maybe look to trade him too. I don't think that's the case. I think in a worst case scenario, he plays this year under the franchise tag and then goes to free agency next year. But there's still a world in which they can get an extension done. And I think it behooves the Bengals to do that.
Well, you mentioned they're not only negotiating with him, but also still with Ja'Marr Chase. How important are those two players to the team? I mean, how much do they need T. Higgins and Ja'Marr Chase?
Well, Ja'Marr Chase definitively, and T is an important piece. But again, you got to also, like I said, weigh the injury history. Last week at the scouting combine in Indy, I was there, and Duke Tobin, the director of player personnel, said, hey, we know we're going to have to make Ja'Marr Chase the highest paid non-quarterback in NFL history. So they know where that number is. I think it's a matter of juggling length of time of contract, the guaranteed money they're going to end up having to pay Ja'Marr. I think that's the deal that gets done before anything else, to be honest with you. I think the T thing may even go up to the 11th hour in July to get one done, or then decide he's going to have to play on the franchise tag. They know they have to pay Ja'Marr. Ja'Marr is arguably the best wide receiver in the NFL. T. Higgins is probably a top 25 and maybe a top 20-ish. You pay for the number one guy. That the other guy, you got to, again, weigh where is the line in the sand? What is the number that you're comfortable paying?
You just mentioned a minute ago that free agency starts next week. What is that going to mean for the Bengals? How do you see that playing out for the team?
Yeah, like I said, I mean, they need a guard. They need an interior tackle. They might need two edge rushers, defensive ends, at least one they need. They're going to probably need a linebacker. It's a lot that they have to get done. Again, you can do some of this through the draft, and they will supplement it, but their drafts haven't been very good of late. And so do you trust your draft process to fill these needs? Or do you trust proven NFL tape? And that's the quandary they're in at the moment. You know, having Joe Burrow on your roster, having Ja'Marr Chase on your roster, having T. Higgins on your roster, some of these things they've done well, but in some places they have not. Successful teams have players on their initial four-year rookie contracts making big contributions. The Eagles paid a bunch of stars, but they also had a lot of guys on rookie contracts, which, you know, are very team-friendly contracts. They're four-year deals, and you know, usually that you don't get paid really until your second contract in the NFL. And so they had guys performing at cheaper rates. The Bengals have not been able to do that very successfully. They need to get doing that starting now, because they're having to pay a lot of different people, and in some cases, a lot of people: Joe Burrow, Ja'Marr Chase, et al. Big-time money.
Well, and the Eagles did pretty darn well with that lineup that you
they
talked
sure did.
About. So, what did the Eagles do right that the Bengals haven't been able to do right?
draft well. I mean, they've drafted really well. They had a bunch of young guys on that defense who were playing on rookie contracts, and then they were able to pay Saquon Barkley as a free agent. They were able to pay both of their star wide receivers, Devontae Smith and A.J. Brown. They were able to pay their quarterback, Jalen Hurts. Not Joe Burrow money, mind you, but still pay their quarterback. So that's the scenario that you like. You want to be able to pay your stars, but you can't just pay your stars and then have to all of a sudden hit the free agency where you have to pay for other position groups. You got to do that some to supplement your roster. But good teams, their roster is built a good chunk through the draft, and then you try to pay and retain your own guys and then return it through good drafts. And the Eagles have done a really good job at that, especially on defense.
Well, you just listed a pretty long shopping list the Bengals have going into free agency. Do they have enough money? I mean, they have enough room in the spending cap to get all that done?
Yeah, it's a great question. There's a wonderful website called overthecap.com. It has the Bengals listed with about $51 million in salary cap space. I always caution people, when you look at that, subtract about 15 mil from that, because it doesn't take into account paying for draft picks, paying for practice squad players. The Bengals hold some money back in case an injury occurs so they can go sign some guys. So it usually has been universal that whatever number you see before free agency, subtract about 15 mil. Now, again, if they trade Trey Hendrickson, that gives them another $16 million in space. If they cut Jermaine Pratt, that gives them another $5.8 million in space. If they cut Zach Moss, a running back, that gives them another $3.5 million in space. So they've got the space to get things done, including the extension for Jamar Chase, probably the extension for Higgins, and then be able to go out and plug the gaps. But you also then have to identify guys that can plug the gaps successfully for you, too.
Is it too early to make any predictions about how good this season's going to be?
Yes. You check back with me after free agency, because honestly, I think a lot of it depends on what can they get done in free agency. Are we going to still be talking about a Jamar Chase contract in July and August in training camp? Are we going to see T. Higgins standing on the side, not happy about playing on the franchise tag? Yeah, I think it's just a tad too early, unfortunately.
Okay, well, we'll have to invite you back then.
I love to come back.
I've been talking with Local 12 News digital sports reporter and host of the Skinny Podcast, Richard Skinner. Thanks so much for your time today, Richard.
Thanks, Lucy. Take care.
You too. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. If you miss our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening. Hope you have a good weekend.